It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A solid skillet is a staple in any home cook's toolkit, but with hundreds of combinations of materials, coatings, and features, it's hard to know what kind to keep in your kitchen. It's Food Friday, and our next guest has put those skillets to the test. She'll tell us how to choose the best frying pans for our cooking needs and how to properly use and care for them. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your go-to skillet to cook with? What do you like about it? Have you bought pans that turned out to be duds? What questions do you have for our skillet expert? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa McManus is an executive editor for America's Test Kitchen Reviews. She also co-hosts the popular ATK YouTube series called Gearheads. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Now, you are a gear person for cooking. Can you talk us through the kind of tests you put skillets through to review them?
Well, when we test skillets or anything else at America's Test Kitchen, we buy them at retail just like everybody else. We look at what's available. We bring them into the kitchen and we use them in ways that we would typically use that piece of equipment. So if it's skillets, we might fry eggs or sear steaks or cook some vegetables. We may put it in the oven because sometimes you'll make something like a shepherd's pie and want to brown the top or toast up some breadcrumbs on top of some mac and cheese. So we'll do that. We'll also try to abuse it to see if we can find out how durable it's going to be in your kitchen over time.
What are some of the most common mistakes we might make when buying new frying pans? And mistakes, I've made a few in this category, I got to say.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think the biggest thing I always think about with a skillet is the cooking surface that's going to be available to you. Skillets are sold by their size, and that's measured from rim to rim. So they'll sell like a 12-inch skillet, which is kind of our standard go-to skillet for, you know, families of four, you know, 4 to 6 servings of cooking, even 2 servings in some cases. It's a good size to have a slightly bigger pan, not those little tiny ones you often see. But a 12-inch skillet is measured rim to rim. The way the sides slope in, if they're very steep and sloped and cupped like a bowl, you can end up with less than 8 inches of flat cooking surface on the bottom. And that's not good in a skillet. You don't want that. You don't want a wok shape in your skillet. You want a flat, broad cooking surface, because what's going to make a skillet perform well is to make sure the food isn't crowded. And you need some nice flat surface to get good and hot, to sear, and to make sure food is going to brown instead of steam.
Yeah, one of my common pratfalls with pans is when they don't heat evenly. So I'm burning over on this side and I'm not, you know, still rare on the other side. How can we make sure we get a pan that's going to heat evenly across the surface?
A lot of that comes down to two things. One is you really do need to preheat your pan.
Well, I'm not very patient, but okay.
Yeah, well, really, within 4 minutes, your pan will be good and warm. You're going to put it on, say, medium heat for 4 minutes. Don't do that if it's a nonstick pan without having some oil in there. You never want to heat a nonstick pan empty. You want to put a little bit of oil in there, heat it for about 4 minutes, let it soak all the way through the pan and spread, and then you're not going to get those hot spots. The other thing you can do is make sure that the pan you're buying has a material that it's made up of that is going to conduct heat and spread it evenly through the pan. So the pan can help you or it can get in your way.
Talking to Lisa McManus with America's Test Kitchen. She is helping us choose our kitchen skillets. You can join in with your favorites, your experiences for better or worse, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Matt is with us in Madison. Matt, hi.
Hey.
What did you want to tell us about, Matt?
Yeah, so about a year ago, I picked up like an antique Griswold cast iron skillet, and I really liked using it. I use it for hamburgers, chicken breast, or just to kind of saute up some vegetables, but I've just had a really hard time trying to get seasoning to stick on it. It's like I'll do some oven treatments. I think I have a really nice layer built up, and then like once I go to like sear some chicken on it or something, I notice it'll kind of flake off where I was getting the food on there. So I'm just wondering if the guest has any tips for a really stubborn skillet when it comes to kind of keeping that seasoning on.
Matt, thanks for the call. Seasoning that cast iron skillet, Lisa, it's not working out for Matt.
Yeah, I think what that sounds a lot like to me is that the seasoning is too thick, that you're trying to put too heavy a coat of oil. What seasoning is essentially, if you had bare cast iron, it would look silver and it would be very prone to rusting because exposure to air and moisture will make it rust. Seasoning is really baking on some oil, a very, very thin coat, and that makes the oil polymerize, turn into a coating. It links and bonds together with itself and with the metal of the pan and makes a nonstick coating that's natural. The big trick, though, is thin. You want a really thin coat. So I've seen a lot of systems where, well, suggestions from people to put thick coats of oil on and bake it for an hour in the oven. I did that once, did it six times in the oven for 6 hours over days. And then the first thing I cooked, it came off. It's too thick. The best thing to do is just to put the lightest, tiniest couple of drops of oil on that pan when you're done cooking with it. Don't use soap and scrub the heck out of it. Just, you know, scrub it down a little bit with just salt and some oil. Rinse that out, dry it, put it on the stove, get it nice and warm, and then put really just a couple of drops of oil and get a paper towel, rub that all in. If it looks like it's all gone, that's what you're looking for. It's not gone. It's very thin. And the heat of the pan, you're going to keep it on that low to medium heat, and you're going to just let it cure on there, basically. And that is what's going to give you good seasoning. And you're just going to lay a little bit on each time as you use it. You don't have to do a lot of elaborate seasoning. I would only do that the first time I got a pan is really, you know, maybe if it was an old antique pan. If it's a new pan, a lot of pans like our Best Buy from Lodge, it's black already when you get it. They pre-season it. They heat it up, they spray it with oil, they bake it on, and they've really got this down to a science. This is all they do all day long. So that pan's ready to go when you get it. And then you just maintain it. When you're done cooking, take the food out, rinse it, dry it, wipe the tiniest drop of oil in all over the interior and the exterior if it looks like it needs it. Put it back on that burner, warm it fully through. And it should look matte and not shiny, shouldn't be sticky. And that means you're going to get a nice thin coat of seasoning that's really going to release food.
Matt, hope that helps. Thanks a lot for calling in. Lisa, let's turn to those nonstick pans you mentioned. That's lots of them. That covers a lot of ground. What kind of things are we looking for in nonstick?
Well, you know, one thing that you really need to know is not all nonstick is made the same way. Mm-hmm. Basically, there's a whole bunch of different layers of quality. So there's some really basic cheap ones. It's like when you're painting a room. If you put one layer of paint on, you might see the old color through, but you know, it's thin. It doesn't look good. You put on, you let that fully dry, you add another coat. Nonstick is made that way. They get a pan and they'll put down one layer and cure it on, put down another layer and cure it on, kind of like that seasoning we were talking about. And if it's a really high quality nonstick, it's going to have multiple layers and it's going to be a little bit more durable than a cheap pan. So I think like one thing I would make sure is it's got a good durable nonstick coating. And we've tested a bunch of them. We do this test where we make fried eggs one after another with no fat in the pan, heat it to a very specific temperature, drop the fried egg, and then after a certain amount of time, take it out and we don't use any fat. And once the egg starts to stick, we know that we've already worn out that nonstick coating. Our favorite pan, which is right now it's by OXO, it released up to 75 eggs with no sticking.
Wow.
And then we cook a bunch of other stuff in it and we do that test again. A lot of pans don't make it through that second round. Some of them don't make it through the first round. So there's a real difference in the quality of the nonstick coating, and you want one that's going to hold up as long as possible. Because as we all know, nonstick coatings are not eternal. They're not like cast iron pans where you can renew that surface forever. It's going to go in one direction, which is downhill. And you just want more of a long, gradual slope to that landfill as long as you can. So look for a good one.
And a big point you make in your videos and your writing, Lisa, is these coated pans are not made to be cooked at super high heats. Can you talk about that?
Right. There's two kinds of nonstick coatings on the market right now. One is PTFE, which is polytetrafluoroethylene, and that is a chemical coating. It's the best nonstick out there. It really sticks. It sticks itself to the pan and doesn't stick to any food. But at about 500 degrees, it can start off-gassing. And so you'll see things where they say, "Don't keep your pet birds in the kitchen," et cetera. That's not great for you either. If you've ever heard of the story of the canary in the coal mine, you know that they used to bring canaries into the coal mine because if the canary, passed out, they knew they had a little bit more time to get out of there. It was not a good sign. So, don't get them over 500 degrees if you can help it. And that's kind of easy to do if you've cranked the heat to high, which is also why we always say don't preheat your nonstick pan without oil in it. Most oil will smoke at around 400 degrees. And so it will be smoking, and you'll get a sign to get that thing off the heat long before it's dangerous to you.
Let's go back to
The
our.
other
Oh,
option is
go ahead.
ceramic, actually. The other kind of coating is ceramic, and that has a higher heat tolerance as far as it doesn't really have a ceiling. Ceramic can be very, very hot. The only problem is it's not as durable for as long as PTFE coatings. It tends to get cracks in it. It's a little brittle. Once those cracks happen, it starts to stick, and then it just kind of perpetuates. It goes downhill a lot faster, but you don't have to worry about the off-gassing.
Let's go back to our callers. Linda is with us in Middleton. Linda, hi.
Hi, I would like to recommend a pan I got from Wisconsin Cutlery on University Avenue, and it is called a Kyocera. It's a non-stick pan, and I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly.
How do you spell the name?
Kyocera.
Kyocera. Okay, and what do you like about it, Linda?
Things don't stick, and it's super easy to clean.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, that's actually our Best Buy ceramic pan. We tested a full lineup of ceramic nonstick pans, and our winner is by Green Pan, the Valencia, and our Best Buy is that pan.
Well, well done, Linda. Thanks a lot. Good luck. I hope long life to that pan. It's Food Friday. We're talking to kitchen product reviewer Lisa McManus about skillets, what to buy, what to watch for, how to make the best use of them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you use mostly nonstick pans, what do you like about them? If you had a hard time using or caring for your cookware at all, if you're a cast iron fan, what's your secret? What's your strategy for keeping it as nonstick as possible? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with kitchen equipment reviewer Lisa McManus from America's Test Kitchen. We're talking about skillets, what to buy, when to use them, how to care for them. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite must-have pan in your collection? Is there something you'd want to recommend to someone else? Or do you need some advice from our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Clara is calling from on the road right now. Clara, hi. What did you want to bring up? Are you there, Clara? I think Clara's not hearing us. Claire wanted, I got a note to ask, about PFAS chemicals in nonstick pans. This is a big issue here in Wisconsin, Lisa. These PFAS chemicals in our waterways. Is that something you've been tracking as you look at nonstick pans?
Yes, it's a lot of concern with nonstick in that regard because it's something that comes out during manufacturing. It's not in your pan when you're using it, but during manufacturing, it gets into the runoff. That gets into the waterways, as I understand it. One of the options that we like to offer instead of nonstick, it's so easy to use. We love that it's so easy. It releases food and, it's easy to lift. It's lightweight compared to cast iron. But we really love to say, try a carbon steel pan. Carbon steel has some great nonstick ability. It's natural nonstick. It's like cast iron in that you season it and you take care of it. And it gives you this beautiful release, but it's more lightweight than cast iron. So it's easier to handle for people who can't really hoist that giant cast iron pan around.
Clara, thanks for calling in. Sorry we lost that. Sorry we lost that connection with you. Pat joins us now in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
You're excited about a pan, Pat. I can tell.
No, I'm excited. It's Friday and I'm done with work.
All right.
It's been a week of Mondays.
What did you want to tell us about?
My favorite is my 10-inch Lodge cast iron skillet. If I could find a older cast iron skillet than mine, I would love it even more. But I've been using that skillet for frying all sorts of different types of meats, steaks, the bacon, and everything else in between. But my absolute favorite use for it is making cornbread. That is my absolute favorite.
Awesome. Pat, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. And that, yeah, Lisa, the one beauty about thing about cast iron skillets is they transfer really well into the oven, or I've used them on the grill as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one way I tested the cast iron skillets that we have in our latest review is I baked cornbread in each and every one of them. And I have to agree, it makes the best cornbread.
Pat, thanks a lot for that. And you talk to a lot of people about pans and skillets, Lisa. My read is that if somebody's excited about a particular pan, it's going to be cast iron. That brings out the enthusiasm in some people, it seems like.
Absolutely. I mean, it's great. You know, people talk about vintage cast iron. Some of those are gorgeous pans, and it's so much fun to, you know, look for them in yard sales and get a great deal on them because people find them all rusty and think they're ruined, and they're not. You just scrub that rust off and oil it and heat it, and it's really ready to go again. And you really can't destroy those pans. And you could drive over them with a truck. They'd probably still be fine.
Pat, thanks
what
a lot.
What else can you say, you know, of kitchenware that you can buy something like that and 100 years later, it's still going strong, right?
Thanks a lot, Pat, for calling in. Deborah is with us now in Elkhorn. Deborah, hi. Are you there, Deborah? Okay, Deborah wants some, Dutch oven recommendations. The one she has is coated on the inside, discolored, hard to clean. Lisa, I just got a Dutch oven. My wife got me one for Christmas. I didn't know I needed it. I love it. I'm using it so much. Any Dutch oven recommendations?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We love Dutch ovens in the test kitchen. We use them for so many things. You know, we fry in them. They're great for making fried chicken or French fries because they have their own splatter wall on the sides. We bake bread in them. They make the most amazing bread. And obviously soups and stews. So many ways that we use those things. But I would say if you are looking for a Dutch oven, our favorite has been Le Creuset for so many years. And then our best buy would be one from Cuisinart that's very similar. They both have that broad cooking surface I was talking about with skillets, very important. You can brown beef in fewer batches if you're making a stew, and there's less chance that anything's going to burn because you're not doing multiple batches. You may be able to get through all the beef that you're making in maybe two batches instead of four. And then light colored interior. And that gets to that question of it being stained. We like this cream colored interior because you can really see in that pan and you can judge the browning and you can tell if things are getting burned. There are some Dutch ovens that have a black interior. It's harder to judge if you're burning that fond, those blackened bits or browned bits at the bottom that really create a lot of the flavor in that soup or stew. So a light colored pan on the interior is what we look for, but they can discolor. And you really shouldn't worry too much about that. It's fine. It means you're using your pan. If it gets too dark, you can do one part of bleach to two parts of water, let it soak overnight and rinse that out really well. And it will lighten up quite a bit, if not look good as new.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Linda is with us in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say the fellow that called in with the Griswold, I think he's just got to slow down with that fry pan. Those are the best old cast iron fry pans. And let it heat up on the burner first, low, before he puts the food in. And you can do eggs over easy. Stay everything. Just start it out. Let it heat up completely first. And then when it comes to washing it, just pour hot water in it and let it sit, and then take a little scrubbier a cloth and wash it out and rinse it with hot water and let it dry. Don't add any soap. And it's a wonderful thing.
Linda, thanks a lot for that call. Oh, yeah, at least I meant to ask. You mentioned cleaning without soap. Soap ruins our seasoning on cast iron skillets. Is that right?
Here's the thing. It won't ruin it if it's well-established seasoning. If it's newly established seasoning, you can kind of take a step back in the seasoning. It will break up the oil instead of, you know, letting it polymerize on the surface. So you don't want to remove the oil. You can actually just take the food out, rinse it with hot water, as the caller just said. She gave perfect advice. And then pat it dry, put it back on the stove, let it get nice and warm again, not super ripping hot, just fully warm, and the tiniest drops of oil, rub that in there. If you're worrying about old oil or old food, that is going to heat up, and it's not going to be unsanitary. It's not, you're not baking old food on there. You maybe have traces of the oil, but that will polymerize and become the coating of the pan. It's not unsanitary. So you don't need the soap. If you use a little bit of it, once the pan is well seasoned, it's not going to really hurt, but you really don't need to.
Linda, thanks a lot for that call. And Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It was so much fun.
That's Lisa McManus, executive editor for America's Test Kitchen Reviews. She joined us on Food Friday for a look at skillets. You can see more of her work in the popular America's Test Kitchen YouTube series called Gearheads. And you can keep sharing your pots and pans favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you found an amazing old cast iron skillet, maybe at a garage sale somewhere that you rely on all the time. Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the nation marks Juneteenth, commemorating key moments in the end of slavery here in the United States. Join Kate and her guests for some perspective on that holiday and what it means in 2023, and join in with your thoughts. That's coming up Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Have you ever been in an event, a party, neighborhood gathering, whatever, and there was a bouncy house or bouncy castle, and you thought, why do the kids get to have all the fun in there? Well, if so, turns out you're not alone. The Wall Street Journal reports there's been a growing trend of bouncy house rentals for grown-ups. Multiple companies around the country offer bouncy house experiences designed for adults, sometimes paired with a DJ and or food truck. And yes, drinking is often involved. They quote a Milwaukee finance writer who's a frequent guest here on the Ideas Network, who actually booked a bouncy house for her wedding reception. I was kind of down on the idea to begin with, but I'm not a big fan of weddings and receptions as a genre. So yeah, anything to shake that up, I am all for it. A consistent message from adult partygoers who have tried the bouncy house: you're not 5 years old anymore. Be careful in there to avoid injuries. Can we get a bouncy house in our WPR budget? I'm guessing probably, yeah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what does a French horn sound like when you distort it or mix it with a synthesizer? The director of UW-Madison's Electroacoustic Research Space joins the show to share some of the new sounds he's come up with. Now, U.S. Olympic track and field champion Tori Bowie died tragically last month at the age of 32. Earlier this week, the autopsy report revealed that she died from pregnancy complications. The medical examiner in her case determined that Bowie may have suffered from eclampsia, a disorder related to high blood pressure during pregnancy. The gold medalist was 8 months pregnant and was otherwise in good health. Her unexpected death served as a stark reminder of the maternal health risks involved in pregnancy and the disproportionate effects on Black women in particular. We're learning more about those health risks and disparities in pregnancy, along with efforts to solve them. Tiffany Green is an assistant professor in the departments of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at UW-Madison. I talked to her earlier today. Now, let's start by talking about this tragic story about Tori Bowie. Can you talk about eclampsia? And this is more common pre-eclampsia. What are those for people who aren't familiar?
So for those who aren't familiar, there are certain conditions in pregnancy, especially those related to high blood pressure, that can be very dangerous for the birthing parent or the baby. Preeclampsia and eclampsia often happen before labor and delivery, but they could actually happen after those points as well.
What are some of the risks and signals that this may be coming, preeclampsia and then eclampsia?
A big one is elevated blood pressure, which is one of the reasons why clinicians, I'm not a clinician, but one of the reasons why they follow pregnant people so closely in terms of blood pressure is making sure that you don't have those conditions, because they can be fatal, as we saw here, and they can result in all kinds of maternal morbidity and mortality. It can also cause organ failure, all kinds of things that are just incredibly dangerous, which is why clinicians stay on top of it so heavily. Since some of the symptoms in addition to high blood pressure are going to be things like swelling of the extremities, like your hands and your feet.
Now, we know that the United States has a higher incidence of maternal mortality compared to other countries. And you and I have talked in the past. That's not evenly distributed. Very big racial disparities. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes, you know, and I when I thought about coming here, I wish I had easy answers. I wish I could give your listeners an easy answer as to why that's the case. But as I've shared with you before, we've identified this disparity in 1917, over 100 years ago, and even before that. And so these disparities continue to persist. But one reason, of course, is that, you know, that people at structural disadvantages, like racially marginalized groups and other groups, come into pregnancy without having the same access to healthcare prior to getting pregnant. You know, they experience other stressors. There are so many things that determine why Black birthing people and pregnant people come into pregnancy with more challenges relative to other groups.
Yeah, when we hear a story like the tragic one about Tori Bowie, I think we think about, okay, what could we have done in the days before this, or maybe in the months? As you and I have talked about in the past, we might be needing to start years before. Can you talk about some of the structural things out there that might be years in the making before that pregnancy even happens that raises that risk?
Well, there are so many factors in that matrix. One of them is what we talked about before, is where you live, where you work, where you play. And we know that that factors such as segregation, right, are linked to poor health outcomes among people, including Black people, such as high blood pressure, right? So those are things that matter. Making sure that you and to be honest with you, I don't think that healthcare is the only answer or even the hugest answer. But clearly, with things like preeclampsia and eclampsia, monitoring by a healthcare provider is also super important to have. So you know, my view, as I've always been pretty transparent about, is really thinking about the very structure of our society and how it predisposes people to be sick and to come into pregnancy with more challenges relative to others. And I want to be clear that this is not a story about individual level behaviors or individual level failings. It's about the way that we structured our society in a way that continues to promote inequality.
Talking to Tiffany Green, assistant professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at UW-Madison, looking at maternal health risks, eclampsia, preeclampsia, the long-term things that can put people at higher risk. Let's take it to the pregnancy now. And we've heard account after account in recent years, and before that, Tiffany, Black moms not being listened to by healthcare providers, poor communication sometimes from providers. What kind of things can we do to improve that communication and the care at that stage?
You know, that's always a challenging question for me to answer, Rob, because I think we do know, we do have evidence that that discrimination and racism in an aggregate sense, these environments are contributing to worse outcomes. But I don't think we have a really good handle on the links between provider beliefs and behavior and actual treatment. And that is a really tricky and difficult thing for me to express, because I want to be clear. It's not that I'm minimizing the role of discrimination in these kinds of behaviors. It's that we don't really have as good a handle as I would like us to have on those outcomes. I think what we can do is really do more to make sure that we are having patient-centered medical treatment, that we are listening to pregnant people, that we're making sure that they have the resources that we need. One example, full disclosure, I'm involved in the evaluation. I think I shared this before with you, is the ConnectRx program in Dane County. And that is a program that supports Black pregnant people with certain risk factors, including being unhoused, maybe experiencing food insecurity, stressors, and it connects them with community-based organizations to make sure that they are getting their social needs met. And in addition, it assigns them a doula if they would like one. And that doula accompanies them at labor and delivery if they would like, and also supports them postpartum. And I want to say it's not responsible to speculate about what happened in Tori's case, mm-hmm. but it's really clear that we are a society that often leaves pregnant people and birthing people by the wayside in terms of social supports. And one of the key things that matters in terms of social supports are people that can not just help you take care of the baby, but people can watch you for symptoms like postpartum eclampsia, right? Those things matter in terms of watching for symptoms of severe maternal morbidity that can turn into something worse.
When you look at Wisconsin in particular, what do you see when it comes to these disparities we're talking about and ways to try to bridge them here?
Yeah, so we do certainly experience disparities in pregnancy-related morbidity in general. Those disparities are lower in absolute terms relative to national averages. However, the disparities are wider. Actually, the group that has the highest rates of pregnancy-related morbidity are indigenous populations in Wisconsin, followed very closely by Black birthing populations, right? So this is something that's really important to understand. And the same is true for pregnancy mortality, right? We have lower levels of pregnancy-related mortality, but the disparities, Black-white disparities, are wider, right? And so those are some things to think about. So what can we do about it is the million-dollar question. Mm-hmm. One is realize that this is a complicated thing that we want to be able to say, let's fix it at the hospital level. Let's fix medical care providers. And while I want to be clear that we do need to fix medical systems, that's not where the majority of our deaths are coming from. A lot of what we don't talk about is a lot of pregnancy-related deaths in Wisconsin are coming as a result of things like overdoses, right? They're coming from things like other cardiovascular conditions, right? These are things that we need to fix in terms of our policies, right? This is not just an individual level behavior thing. It is a policy decision that we have made, and we need to address those things quickly.
We'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yes, no problem. Great to be here.
That was Tiffany Green, assistant professor in the Departments of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at UW-Madison. She was with us today to talk about maternal health and pregnancy complications after the recent tragic death of Olympic track and field champion Tori Bowie. Coming up, a UW-Madison music professor joins the show to tell us what electroacoustic music is and to tell us about how he and students experiment with instruments and sound. That's coming up next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, what does a French horn sound like in your head? Maybe it's something like this. But what if you changed how it sounds with a distortion pedal, like you might see used with a guitar? That sound is from a collection of recordings called Air Names. It was made by our next guest with the help of the Electroacoustic Research Space, or EARS for short, at UW-Madison School of Music. It's a studio that lets musicians experiment with, you know, your normal acoustic instruments, a French horn or a flute, say, and electronic instruments like synthesizers to come up with really different, maybe even completely new kinds of sounds and music. Dan Grabois is an assistant professor of horn and the director of UW-Madison's Electroacoustic Research Space. I talked to him last year. Paint us, please, a picture of this lab.
This lab is a former classroom that has been repurposed. So it's in the humanities building, but it doesn't have the aura of the humanities building. It's updated a little bit, and it is chock full of electronic instruments.
What was the inspiration for you to have not just these electronic instruments, but this interface between traditional acoustic instruments and all this electronic gear?
Well, for me, that started when I got to UW. I had before been the chair of contemporary performance at the Manhattan School of Music, and I hired a colleague to come and teach electronic music to my students, and they were making incredible sounds, and I thought, wow, I could change the sound of the horn and play a much bigger variety of music. So when I got here, I was provided with some research funds, and I started buying pedals and microphones and that sort of thing. And I made the Air Names recording that you just played a little bit of, which was mostly featuring the horn in various kinds of distortion and with effects on it. From there, everything derived out of an email that I received one summer. And it said, we are offering a round of UW 2020 large equipment grants. And the idea behind this grant was really, hey, chemistry department needs an electron microscope, and so does biochemistry. So let's provide one electron microscope and have them share. And I thought, well, I could put together a ton of pieces of electronic music equipment and call that large equipment. And so I put in an application. I got everything I asked for. So thank you, Worf.
Now let's check out another clip, another taste of the music. This is from your latest project, released coming out in October, I think, called Fire Names. I think I'm hearing a fairly unprocessed French horn out front there. What's going on behind it, though?
So this really is electroacoustic music. The French horn's completely unprocessed, except that it's being recorded, obviously, mm-hmm. So there's some amount of mixing going on. But yes, so what I did is I wrote a tape track. Of course, there's no tape involved anymore. Everything is digitally recorded. But I used the instruments in EARS to create this 44-minute long tape track, and then I wrote a horn part to go on top of it. And so when I was recording the horn part, which I did in my basement with EARS microphones, I didn't have to distort the horn at all. I wanted it to be very pure, and I played over that tape track.
Now, I'm kind of a music nerd. As I looked at the list of your electronic equipment, it includes things like old Moog synthesizers, a theremin, I think, and then some things I've never heard of, including a Continuum fingerboard.
Yeah, that's actually if I had to choose a favorite child, it would be the Continuum fingerboard. It's an instrument that's been in production for something like 15 or 20 years, but it changes every few years and is updated. It was invented by someone named Lippold Hocken, who teaches engineering at the University of Illinois. And the reason it's called a continuum is it has a keyboard, but the keyboard is made of squishy foam with the notes more painted on the foam than actual separate notes. So you can drag your finger along the keyboard and make it go continuously, hence continuum fingerboard. And it's a very expressive instrument.
So that makes me like a fretless bass, where usually you'd have distinct notes there, but without the frets, you can move up and down. Same thing. I never would have thought it possible for a keyboard.
Yeah, it's an incredible invention. And it responds also in several other directions. So that side-to-side or X-axis is operating with the instrument, but there's also a Y axis. So the keyboard has a certain thickness, and it's a synthesizer. So for some of the sounds, as you move your finger further away from you or more towards you, the sound will transform. And then the Z axis, how hard you push down, generally controls how loud or soft you play, but it can be programmed to control anything you want.
Talking to Dan Graboy from UW-Madison, director of the Electroacoustic Research Space. We're checking out some of their music, and I want to give a listen to, I think you're featuring your favorite kid, as you said, the Continuum Fingerboard, in this excerpt from Fire Names. Here's a listen. I think I'm hearing what is the Continuum Fingerboard with those where you can, yep.
That bass line is Continuum Fingerboard, but the thing that goes da-dee-da-da-da-da is also Continuum Fingerboard with a different sound. This is all recorded multi-tracked, so you record one thing and then you put something else on top and you have infinite tracks that you can use.
Okay, one more taste of that, I think. A later part here in Fire Names. Tell us a little more about what we're hearing there.
Right. So everything you heard there is Continuum, and a big, big, juicy, fat sound on the bottom. And then on top, this sort of Asian-sounding instrument, which is really interesting. It uses that Z-axis, how hard you push against it. The harder you push against it, the more it goes boing and bends up. So if you just tap it, it goes ding, 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 ding. And as you push harder, boing, boing, boing. So it makes a really kind of an interesting ornamented sound.
Okay, so this is in effect a music laboratory. What kind of things do music students get in and experiment, play with in there?
So I have a band that's a student ensemble. It's actually a class. And the band is called $2 Broom. And if anybody gets the reference, they win the prize for the day. But we improvise using the instruments. So students learn how to play the instruments, which is usually pretty easy. Most of the instruments have a very tactile interface. And in fact, for, say, a cellist or a violinist that has become very, very engrossed in their technique on their instrument, putting their hands in front of the theremin and moving them around and see what happens is a really revelatory experience. It's no longer about just how you make that vibrato with your left hand and how you draw the bow, but just pure experimentation. So we go on stage with this band at the end of each semester and play for about an hour with nothing written down and nothing planned.
Okay, but suppose somebody comes there with a cello or a French horn or whatever. They've devoted their life to this instrument in a lot of ways, and they're playing through some of these processors and synthesizers and things like that. What is their reaction? Is it, this is cool, or wait, this isn't what my instrument is supposed to sound like?
Usually their reaction is something that I can't even quote on the radio.
They're generally in a bad way.
In a good way.
Okay.
They're usually so excited about what their instrument will sound like. And we do that. For instance, we had a cellist play on our last concert, and he did some cello playing as well as playing other of the ears instruments. And he was running through effects. And what's so interesting is that you find that your playing changes based on what you're hearing, which is not that surprising, but it really draws that idea into focus, especially as you think of each musician as kind of a composer when you're improvising. So the ideas that are generated are inspired by the sound that's coming into your ears.
Briefly, as we wrap up, live gigs for $2 Broom or any other projects coming out where we could see this in action?
Yes, but you'll have to stay tuned because we set our concerts kind of in the middle of the semester. We figure out a time when everyone's free and when we'll be ready, but they may be billed as the Electroacoustic Improv Ensemble or $2 Broom. I'm not sure how our
like any band. Like what's the real name?
Yeah. The real name, as far as I'm concerned, is $2 Broom.
Dan, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Dan Graboy. He's an assistant professor of horn and director of the Electroacoustic Research Space, or EARS, at UW-Madison. I talked with him last year about his work at EARS and to share some of the experimental music he's made there. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the Human Rights Campaign says there's a state of emergency for LGBTQ Americans. Find out why and look at the long story of progress and pushback. and it's mosquito and tick season in Wisconsin. A state expert joins the show for a look at the season so far and how to protect ourselves from diseases that can be carried by ticks and mosquitoes. You can share a condition report from your own backyard or your latest hike. What are you seeing out there? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You can also share your questions about mosquitoes and ticks along the way. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.